I'm Brandi Cruz. This is Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. And if you have not become a subscriber already, remember we do an episode just like this every single Wednesday. You can sign up at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. We're going to start off the show talking about Biden's primetime address in Philadelphia last night. There are a lot of differing opinions about the optics of it, what it looked like, the color of the wall behind him, the Marines standing behind him, his overall message. We're going to dive into all of that. Also, a follow-up to a story we did last week on Florida Report that we're going to talk about again on Florida Report at the end of the show. Remember how Ron DeSantis announced the arrest of a few dozen people for voter fraud because they weren't qualified to vote because they were either, you know, murderers or rapists? Well, it turns out that the state of Florida might have handed the defense of those suspects a key piece of evidence we'll discuss. Also, I talked about on the subscriber-only episode on Wednesday what I believe is the most dangerous proposal to come out of the pandemic era in this country, and it's happening down in the state of California. Well, it turns out that Washington State has a similar proposal, policy rather, when it comes to what nurses and doctors can and cannot say about COVID-19, vaccines, et cetera. We'll get into that. And also, Fridays with Friends is an interesting one today, a little bit different, complete departure from politics. My former security guard, who was with me during the Summer of Love, Chaz Chop debacle, who was famously caught on camera disarming rioters of stolen Seattle police rifles, is going to join us for Fridays with Friends. But first, like I said, I want to talk about Biden's address he delivered from Independence Hall in Philadelphia last night in prime time. Interesting that it was in prime time and a lot of the networks chose not to carry it live. But of course, there's clips of it everywhere. Just to set it up, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre was asked about kind of the content of the president's speech before he gave it on Thursday. And she made very clear that it was not going to be a politically oriented speech.
Is tonight a political speech?
No, it's not a political speech. This is an opportunity, again, for the president to directly have a conversation with the American people.
Why don't you listen to parts of President Biden's speech and you tell me whether you think it was political.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic. America must choose to move forward or to move backwards. MAGA Republicans have made their choice. They embrace anger. They thrive on chaos. Vote, vote, vote.
The bulk of the speech was about rejecting an entire voting base in America, millions of people who support the former president. Yet the White House wanted us to think, and still, by the way, wants us to think, that it wasn't political. Here's the press secretary being asked post-speech about her pre-speech comments that it wasn't going to be political.
The way we see it here, and I would argue the way many Americans across the country see it, is standing up for democracy is not political. Denouncing political violence is not political. Defending rights and freedom is not political. Making clear that the challenges facing the nation is not political. We don't call any of that political. We see that as leadership, and we see that as presidential.
Now, do I support Donald Trump or the MAGA agenda? No, I don't. But am I dumb enough to believe that that speech wasn't political? No, and I'm assuming that you guys aren't either. So why would the White House think Americans are dumb enough to believe that this wasn't a political speech? Now, let's talk about the imagery of the speech before we get a little bit deeper into the content and the takeaways. A lot has been made about the deep red background that was behind Biden, and also the Marines that were standing behind him in shadow. So first, it's important to note that Independence Hall wasn't just lit up in this blood red. It was also deep blue, but a lot of the shots of Biden, you know, face on, you couldn't see the blue on the side, which I think would have made a difference. I don't know if it was strategic for President Biden and his team to want him to stand in front of the deep red hue and make it this brooding, apocalyptic feeling. It was strange. And then as for the Marines standing behind Biden, look, I certainly think it's inappropriate to use members of the armed services in that way. I will note that Republican presidents have done the same thing. You know, there are photos of President Trump with Marines standing behind him giving an official remarks. So it's certainly been done before. This was a little strange because they're in shadow, and it almost seemed like they were part of the set. Like, it was very intentional to have them draped in shadow in that way. So anyway, yeah, the imagery was weird. But I gotta say, the optics of it are the least of my concern. It is the content of what the president said that is most concerning.
MAGA Republicans have made their choice. They embrace anger. They thrive on chaos. They live not in the light of truth, but in the shadow of lies.
I agree with a lot of what the president had to say about the dangers of folks who deny elections. You know, you've had some of these quote-unquote MAGA candidates, people who are backed by former President Donald Trump, who don't believe that he lost the 2020 election, you know, who cry voter fraud. You look at Carrie Lake in Arizona, the gubernatorial candidate. When she was behind on primary election night, she was already talking about, you know, fraud and wanting to do an audit. And then when she ended up winning, all of a sudden there wasn't this concern about voter fraud influencing the outcome of the election. And so I think a lot of that is just frankly bullshit. And it is dangerous. And I am concerned. I don't want President Trump to be president again. But to think that, follow me on this one, because I'm trying to stuff my emotions in on this because it really pisses me off. The media made Donald Trump. The media made Donald Trump's presidency happen. They carried every single event he did, all the remarks he did, wall-to-wall live coverage during the 2016 presidential election. Every crazy remark he said was in headlines all over the country. CNN, MSNBC focused on it nonstop. They gave him enough attention to take what was a dead-on-arrival campaign and make Donald Trump the president of the United States. Their hatred for him during all that period made Donald Trump the president of the United States. And after the media made Donald Trump the president of the United States, they spent the next 6 years calling him a threat to the country, a threat to democracy, a dangerous man, painting him as the worst thing that has ever happened to the country. Completely lacking self-awareness that they were the ones that put him in that position to begin with. And now you fast forward and you have Joe Biden in this primetime address talking about the existential threat that MAGA Republicans present to our country. Yet the speech comes just after a primary election where the campaign arm of the Democratic Party for Congress, the DCCC, spent donor funds to prop up the very candidates that Joe Biden spent more than 20 minutes last night warning the country about. I have a big problem with that. You don't get to, as a Democratic Party, spend money propping up these candidates, playing Russian roulette. You say they're an existential threat to democracy. You pour money into their campaigns so they can beat more mainstream Republicans because you think the MAGA Republicans will be easier to beat in November. But all of this is starting to seem like part of a larger plan. For Democrats to spend donor money sending MAGA candidates forward to the November election, only for Joe Biden to now, in the last couple months, and in a very big public way last night, paint those exact candidates as a threat to the country, as a threat that must be extinguished. And I can't help but wonder whether those two things are both part of the same plan for Democrats to keep control in November, in an election year where we all expected them to lose overwhelmingly due to the state of the country. I will say Democrats are doing a pretty damn good job of keeping the attention, keeping the focus, keeping the conversation on Trump, on MAGA Republicans, keeping the conversation away from the crisis at the border, the economy, the crime crisis in the country, rising costs, rising gas prices. If this is a strategy, it is turning out to be a pretty effective strategy for Democrats. But it is also incredibly hypocritical. Just like the media. Raising alarm bells about Donald Trump for 6 years after putting him in the White House. No self-awareness, no self-reflection. And then the standard bearer of the Democratic Party getting up in front of the blood-red background, warning Americans about MAGA Republicans after his own party propped up MAGA Republicans in August. Shame on them.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic.
This should be as disgusting to Democrats as it is to Republicans. You can't complain about a monster that you created. What I would like to see is every single Democratic congressional candidate in the country condemn what the DCCC did in the primary elections. And by the way, remember I had Congresswoman Kim Schreier on the show after she won the primary, asking her about that tactic. Here's what she said.
No opinion.
That's not good enough. Every single Democratic current member of Congress and congressional candidate should condemn what the DCCC does. If they want us to believe it all, that they are concerned about the threat that quote unquote MAGA Republicans have for this country. Because I have a really hard time treating Biden's words with sincerity until he and every other Democrat condemns what the DCCC did. Like I said, optics of the speech, whatever. You know, the president wants to get up in official remarks, wants to, 2 months before a critical midterm election, wants to vilify the other party. Honestly, that's not surprising. Wants to do it in front of the blood red backdrop, whatever. Wants to do it with Marines behind him, whatever. It is the utter hypocrisy, though, that I can't abide. And frankly, the president should be ashamed of himself. His press secretary should be ashamed of herself for claiming that it wouldn't be political. You know, Brett Baer at Fox, who's very even keeled, he made a really good point about the speech that Biden gave last night that's worth listening to.
A lot of times when we analyze things, we do things through the prism of how the media would cover it if Donald Trump gave this speech. I think they might not stop talking about it for weeks on end. Because the messaging was so aggressive, it really was also a blueprint for Democratic candidates. This is how we're going to run. This is what you should be talking about. And while he hit tones of optimism about what he thinks about America, he clearly was trying to divide and drive a wedge in the Republican Party. I think they believe, the political advisors to the president, that the more that they're talking about Donald Trump, the more that the country is talking about Donald Trump, the better positioned they are to not be talking about inflation, crime, immigration, etc.
So you know what? Democrats can shout from the rooftops about MAGA Republicans being a threat to the country, but they don't get to do it while simultaneously supporting the very same candidates. On the subscriber-only episode on Wednesday, I talked about what I believe to be the most egregious proposal to come out of the pandemic era. It's happening down in California, Assembly Bill 2098. And essentially what it does is it allows the state to determine whether a medical professional is spreading COVID misinformation or disinformation. And as a result, it can pull someone's license. And the real egregious part of it for me was that misinformation was defined very vaguely. It was information that goes against current medical consensus, essentially. And I mean, that can be, we saw a lot of times during the pandemic that medical consensus changed. around the lab leak theory, the efficacy of vaccines, the efficacy of masking, for instance, the necessity to get boosters or vaccinate young children. You know, these things, and that's normal, right, that our understanding of science or a disease might change over time. And so to think that politicians would say, well, we're going to decide what misinformation is when it comes to a disease that's rapidly changing is really dangerous, and it's really scary. And I thought, well, gosh, I bet Washington State isn't going to be too far behind California, because apparently Governor Inslee has to do everything that Gavin Newsom does. But then a member of the state legislature in Washington tipped me off to the fact that there was a policy put into place in 2021 in Washington State that essentially did the same thing when it came to nurses and doctors. It wasn't a law. I think that's an important distinction. There hasn't been a law passed or proposed in Washington State to crack down on doctors or nurses sharing COVID misinformation or disinformation. But this was a policy put out. The Nursing Care Quality Assurance Commission put out a statement talking about essentially the rules that nurses would have to abide by in Washington State. The statement reads in part, when identifying themselves by their profession, nurses are professionally accountable for the information they provide to the public. Any nurse who violates their State Nurse Practice Act or threatens the health and safety of the public through the dissemination of misleading or incorrect information pertaining to COVID-19, vaccines, and associated treatment through verbal or written methods, including social media, may be disciplined by their board of nursing. Nurses are urged to recognize that dissemination of misinformation not only jeopardizes the health and well-being of the public, but may place their license and career in jeopardy as well. And I just couldn't believe that isn't something that I had heard of. I mean, maybe if it had been a law, I would have heard about it, but, you know, policy from the nursing board, not so much. But this is, I mean, like I said, how do you judge what misinformation is? And who's going to judge what misinformation is? And what if that information changes a couple months later? And so one of the things that I did today is I reached out to the Department of Health in Washington State and the nurses board that put this guidance down. And I just asked them if to date, since this came out, there have been any disciplines handed down as a result of this policy, and if not discipline, any investigations that were launched into nurses or physicians in the state who were accused of spreading COVID misinformation. And so they told me that they're on it. They are looking into this for me. And so it is something I'm going to follow up. So next week, we don't have a Monday show because it's the holiday. We're doing our regular Monday show on Tuesday. And I'm going to be joined by a physician in California who's been speaking out against Assembly Bill 2098 there. And by then, I hope to have information from the Washington State Department of Health that'll tell us whether they have taken discipline against any nurses or doctors for the spread of quote unquote COVID misinformation, and what exactly that misinformation was, because I think that's critical. You know, again, making a difference between disinformation and misinformation. Disinformation is intentionally misleading people. Misinformation is you shared something that you maybe thought was true and it wasn't true. And so I think it's important to note there were some crazy conspiracies out there against COVID that were clearly not true. But there's a big difference between that and, say, a nurse who is warning patients about side effects of the COVID vaccine. And so I promise you that I'll follow up with you on Tuesday about what I hear, if anything, by then, from the State Department of Health in Washington as to whether they have taken disciplinary action against any nurses related to COVID misinformation or disinformation. And of course, we'll have that interview on the ongoing push to get Assembly Bill 2098 into law in California. Every Friday, we like to check in on what's happening in the nation's most insane state. Insane in bad ways, but also in some good ways. Of course, we're talking about Florida. It's our weekly segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Joining us is our Florida-based correspondent, my sister Miranda. We've got some good stories this week out of Florida that I love.
We do.
A follow-up. So Ron DeSantis came out, it was like, what, a week ago now or something, and he said, hey, we've made some arrests of mostly like convicted felons, like rapists and murderers who voted in the state of Florida who weren't supposed to. And it was a big deal because he's like, you know, election integrity. But it turns out that maybe some of those cases have some real issues with them.
Yes, it does, actually. Miami Herald reports that cases against arrested voters on shaky legal ground as Florida issued them voter IDs.
Well, that's a problem.
That's a problem. I mean, there's bound to be some, you know, some holes when you're trying to, you know, fix something and reinstate people's voters' rights. But they actually went and arrested these people, I guess, without really checking. And I read about one guy, there's some body cam footage of him being like, voter fraud, like, I'm a registered voter. And it was just like a whole confusing situation. And I don't know, I guess it's something that I hope doesn't discourage people, because I do think that like keeping tabs on voter fraud is important, but the state has to also make sure that they're doing their due diligence. So they're just showing up and ruining people's days when these people think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. The state is going to have to drop those cases. I mean, that is the lowest level of due diligence that you should do to make sure that, because this is Florida's mistake, right? If the state of Florida were to send me a voter registration card, I fill it out, it's accepted, I'm going to assume that I can vote. And I'm not going to assume that these people knew, like, oh, I got sent a voter card, I'm not supposed to have one. So, I mean, that's like the defense's exhibit A. So I'm assuming they'll dismiss those cases.
Yeah, they got to prove intent. And if somebody's like intentionally registering to vote, that's not intent to defraud the system. So I'm assuming some of these cases are going to get tossed, and they're going to have to do a little work to tighten up on that end.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is this shows them, like, obviously there is a problem with the voting system in Florida that allowed these people to get valid voter registration cards, and so that needs to be fixed, but not at the expense of these people who might not have known that they were doing something wrong.
Absolutely.
I know you're probably not watching Tucker Carlson every night, although you're very good at the way you consume news, because you watch a whole bunch of different things all the time.
I really do, actually. I think I'm into like the human experience, and people fascinate me. So I like to get opinions from all different angles, because to be honest, as a 35-year-old woman, I have friends who have opinions on all different angles. And in order to keep them, I have to be open-minded.
So. Yeah. Well, which is a very good thing. People should model themselves after that practice of watching a variety of things to get to the truth. But I was watching Tucker Carlson the other night, and I saw this live. And you know, I'm a big fan of Miami's mayor, Francis Suarez. I've interviewed him a couple times, also saw him at the southern border when he was there with some other mayors from across the country. And he was on with Tucker Carlson, I'll play a clip of it here, talking about basically how Miami is bucking the trend when it comes to crime and taxes. Here's a portion of that interview.
Turns out if people are healthy, they're happy, they're working, they're not paying a lot of taxes, and they see an increased police presence, they don't have a tendency to commit murder. And that's what's been the Miami miracle story, which is a huge contrast to the Washington nightmare story that you've articulated tonight and over the last few weeks.
So let's talk about crime first, because you've lived in Miami for what, 10 plus years, more than that?
17 years last month.
What? Oh my gosh. Okay, I didn't realize you were that old.
It's math that I plan to stop doing, but
yeah. When you moved there, I remember coming to visit you, and there would be certain areas of town. I remember your boyfriend took us to a certain area of town where they had some really good food, and he made us stay in the car and like, yeah, don't get out of the car. And I remember being very scared in Miami. It was having a huge issue with shootings and homicides. So have you noticed a notable difference in the feeling of safety in Miami as a citizen?
I absolutely have. When I first moved here, the one place that I felt safe always walking around was Miami Beach. When you came back over to the mainland side and in the city, the areas I lived in, the area my college was in, were in an area called Midtown, which is close to downtown. You could not walk down the street. Like, it was absolutely scary. There was street lights out. And honestly, that was back in 2005. And since then, there has been a boom of like industry, of building condos, luxury buildings, people with money coming in from different countries, investing in the city. And I think that quick change forced a lot of that crime completely out. And then in more recent years, what the mayor is talking about in this particular interview is just, you know, he's put a lot of effort into, you know, giving police more funding and creating more police presence. In addition to that, he focused a lot on bringing jobs to the city and lowering taxes. And he says when people have good jobs and pay less taxes and they see police around, there's not as much need for crime, you know. And this interview also talks more about homicides. We're at a record low number of homicides. I think he says 28 for the year, which is unbelievable. You know, he talks about, you know, in the 80s, it was like 300, you know, homicides. And, you know, Miami has a really poor history of crime and violence. So it's kind of nice to be coming out on the sunny side of things.
Yeah, lowest murder rate in Miami since 1930, lowest property tax rate in Miami since like the 60s. When they started recording property tax rates, so probably the lowest in history. And also, the city of Miami has the largest budget surplus that it's ever had. And, you know, the last time I interviewed Mayor Suarez was about his luring tech jobs to the city from cities like Seattle that had stopped appreciating those high-paying jobs. And what people don't realize is, you know, are these gangbangers who'd been shooting people all of a sudden going to become techies? No. But when you have high-paying tech jobs, then you have a whole ecosystem of smaller businesses that have to support the influx of tech workers. And so you have jobs in retail, you have jobs at gyms and dog walkers and restaurants, where all these middle class people can start to really make money. And that makes a difference. And I think that's what people don't understand. Quickly on Mayor Suarez, I've said that I think he would make a wonderful addition to a presidential ticket in 2024 as a vice president. He has floated the possibility, at least he hasn't denied it, that he might be considering a run in 2024. What do you think about that?
I think we've actually talked about this before. I think that he sits in a beautiful middle to the right area that I actually also identify with very well. And I think that that's to me what America needs right now is to come back to the middle and then like just re-identify who we are when it comes to like, you know, money, policy and stuff like that. And we can't do that when we have constantly candidates that pander so far left and right. So I do think that, you know, he would be a great addition to a ticket in 2024, just, you know, for that simple, logical, you know, center-minded reason.
Yeah. And also he's not a household name. And I know that can make a presidential campaign really challenging, but he's very, very charming. I mean, he's good looking, which does help, even if people don't want to admit it. It helps political campaigns. But I think he could get attention very quickly, but also people don't instantly have this really hard negative perception of him, or, you know, one way or the other, because people don't know who he is yet. So he has an opportunity to really introduce himself to the country. All right, you got one more story for us to end on. This is hilarious because I love this California-Florida beef with Gavin Newsom claiming he doesn't want to run for president and then running full-blown political ads in the state of Florida going after Ron DeSantis. Well, it turns out that some of Gavin Newsom's relatives might not hate the state of Florida as much as the governor does.
No, Fox News says Gavin Newsom's in-laws fled from California to Florida during the pandemic. I don't blame them at all. Like, it was a great place to be for these last couple of years, you know, but, you know, as we were kind of talking about, it's just one of those things that you kind of like want to do the research of your immediate circle before you start kicking up dust and causing problems.
One, it's like, you know that they didn't flee there for the weather, right? Because California and Florida, they're both beautiful places to be year round. And so they can't use that as an excuse. Like if you had someone who was locked down like in North Dakota, but they had a vacation place in Florida, of course they're going to go to Florida for the lockdown. This is obviously because California was all locked down. There was nothing to do. Florida was much more open. And California was locked down because of their relative. It's so funny. Oh, that might be my favorite story ever. It's just
good. It's a good one.
It's a good one. All right, Miranda, great stuff today. Thank you so much.
Have a good weekend.
And that has been our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
If every Friday, we do a segment called Friday with Friends, where I bring an interesting friend of mine on to talk about news, politics, sometimes just life. An interesting one today, one of the most trying, I guess is a fair word, moments in my career came during the summer of 2020. Of course, we had just nonstop riots and unrest in the city of Seattle following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. We had the infamous Chaz Chop situation where my crew was mobbed and chased into a fire station. But before that, one of the security guards that we worked with during this period of time was down with us during the worst riot of them all in downtown Seattle. This is something that, you know, you had widespread looting, you had cop cars being burned, and many of you will remember my security guard captured on camera disarming a rioter of a stolen Seattle police rifle. And not only did he do it once, he did it a second time. And honestly, he's just an all-around badass. Well, this really launched someone who was very private into the public spotlight in a huge way. He and I have been friends ever since. And he joined me to talk about kind of how that one instance changed his life and his view in hindsight on everything that went down in the summer of 2020, or as the former mayor of Seattle called it, the summer of love. Joining us on Fridays with Friends is the weapon snatcher, Shooter Rugi. What do you want me to call you these days?
Everyone just calls me Rugi now.
For people who aren't familiar, tell them about the first time we met.
At the newsroom. When we had, before we had to go to work, that's when we actually first met. But the reason why everyone wants to know is because of the 2020 riots in Seattle, where you were reporting on it live and I was your security.
And what some people don't know is that was your first time doing security for a news crew. What were your expectations, I guess, about doing security for a news crew during a protest, which turned into a riot?
A reporter, that was going to be a pain in the butt.
I was not a pain in the butt. I was not, first of all, stop spreading that rumor. I was not a pain in the butt.
No, you weren't. You were really easy to work with. The expectation I really had was there was just going to be a lot of people saying a lot of things that were either going to be, you know, trying to be overly aggressive to start something, or, you know, just really crammed into a tight area with a lot of different things going on and a potential threat. So another big factor is that, you know, you guys got to do your job. So there's a balance of you doing your job to me doing my job.
Have you been out with a lot of news crews since?
Yeah, that was a very active time. But since in 2021, I think once or twice, but this past year.
I was your favorite news crew, I'm guessing.
Definitely the most interesting.
So obviously people know you from, you know, the weapon snatching incident of the AR rifles. I don't think we have to replay that minute by minute because you and I have talked about it before. But, you know, after that happened, how did your life trajectory change?
It was told to me very early on by some friends that my life is now going to be pre and post, and it very much so is. Because of all that and the attention that it garnered, you know, 2020 was a very hard year financially for a lot of people, my family included. So I dived into the attention to be able to start a business off of it and make sure to be able to provide for family. And that was just happened to be into a profession that I'm already passionate about, which is firearms and teaching. So that and the ability to rapidly learn whatever I need to and video work and everything. I started doing YouTube channel off of that with content creation on Instagram as well. Was able to turn it into something that, you know, it's still going itself.
And what kind of path had you been on before the infamous weapon snatcher incident professionally?
Security, private security, executive protection, stuff like that. I had just gotten back home from a contract overseas and I didn't want to travel overseas anymore for work. So I was still, you know, applying to different places and everything and just doing what jobs I could at the time. But coming back home, and then that was during the tensions with, I think it was Syria, where Soleimani was missiled right outside of where I was. And then coming back home and COVID hitting right then, it was a tumultuous time. So, I mean, fortunately, look, the way things happened, it gave me a projected course that I could, you know, mold to what I want to do.
Yeah, looking back at that time, I still don't know, by the way, what your politics are. Because I feel like you disagree with me on a lot of stuff, but, you know, we're like both common sense people. You don't have to tell me what your politics are. But when you look back at, like, having been down in the riots, you know, because you were not only with me during the weapon snatching incident, but also when our crew got mobbed up at what would become the occupied protest zone, when you looked at the news coverage of those events, what was your take on how it was being portrayed by the press versus what you went through personally?
From what I saw on the ground, both with your crew and multiple others at the time, and then what I was seeing in the media, not just in news, but then what was being put on in TV shows, stuff that was going on in there, two totally different worlds. It's like two people sitting down and watching a completely different movie. And in my opinion, it's complete BS. Sitting there saying these are peaceful protests and that people are here, you know, for the common good and shit like that. It says a lot that the people weren't really paying attention to what was going on. Regardless of what the politics were or was for whoever, there was nothing peaceful about it. I remember one thing very specifically that day that you and I were out after I got the rifles returned. We were doing, I think we were doing a live hit in front of an electronic shop full of speakers, like Bose speakers and everything, and JBL speakers. And a dude walks up right behind you while the camera's pointing at it and starts trying to smash the window out. And I just sat there because, like, I'm not going to stop him. I'm going to let him do what he wants. He's not bothering us. And I just started chuckling to myself because, like, you're doing this live on the news. And he couldn't break the window, so he just looked like an idiot. There's nothing peaceful about it. How do you have burning vehicles, rounds popping off, and people breaking into stores like North Face and leaving clothes just strewn all over the place? There's nothing. And people want to sit there and say stuff like that? Go in the middle of it. Tell me if you feel safe.
Yeah, and I tend to think I get stuck sometimes between the intent, are they intentionally misleading the public, or are they looking at different video, you know, from behind the safety of their keyboard? What is it? But for instance, you know, there was a blogger in Seattle who continues to deny that one of those rioters fired one of the rifles that you took away. I mean, accused me of making that up. And her defense was that no protesters would confirm that he had fired it. For the record, the man fired the gun, right?
First of all, deny it all you want. I don't really give a shit. The fact of the matter is he did. He fired three rounds. I had originally thought it was four, but the echo of gunfire inside of the city streets and off the buildings can make it sound like a lot more or less just because of the way the sound bounces. It's actually something that's taught in the military when you're in different terrains, is use the environment to make the gunshot sound from somewhere else. He fired three rounds. There's a video of it. So if someone wants to sit there and look at a video of it and then literally firsthand, the guy who took the gun from him, and sit there and say, oh, it didn't happen. Okay, you're a liar. That's plain and simple.
Yeah, it's insane gaslighting that I see in the Seattle media, just way too much. The other kind of issue that I thought was interesting, and you and I discussed it, you know, we did a story on your heroics right after it happened. And one thing I thought was fascinating was that almost everybody, I would say 99.9% of people, were celebrating what you did. I mean, far left, far right, people in the middle, they were like, this guy is amazing. Was that surprising to you?
In a way, no, because it's hard, because talking about it makes it sound egotistical or smug. But the fact of the matter is, if you were to take like each political belief or ideology and you put them in front of what was going on, I kind of sidestepped every single one. There was, okay, the 2A side. I was using a firearm to over-escalate an issue to de-escalate it, and I didn't have to press around in anybody. Okay, that's great for them. Then you look at the far left and liberal side of everything, and this guy didn't shoot anybody. He, you know, he just took it, and that's what all police should do, and that's what, you know, they should be training to do that. And like, that's a bad idea, because the fact of the matter is, most times that is never the case. Cops are uniformed, they're very overt, and that's the point. I was covert, he didn't know I was there. And the video that went viral was the second rifle. And if I have video timestamp from a nearby security store that shows from the moment he had his hands on the gun, the moment I took it was 6.5 seconds. For someone who doesn't know what's going on, someone who's just like, oh my gosh, this is cool, there's so much else going on, and versus me, who I was focused, I saw what was going on, that's not a lot of time. 6.5 seconds just went by. And then I got us out of there and we left. I didn't have to harm anyone, but there were some people that were really trying to goad me to do it. And there's other video showing that. There was no way it could be twisted. The most criticism I got on it was the prior military guys, you know, and I'm one of them, or executive protection guys saying, oh, he failed his job, he didn't do this, he should have done this, and all that kind of stuff. Well, fact of the matter is, I believe very firmly still that I still did was right, because you were my job to protect. But then my personal duty overtook the fact that, okay, now there's a bigger threat here. Put you guys in the safest place I can and take care of that and get back to you. No one could chop it up. There's two or three things I wish I would have done differently. But overall, politically, it can't be chopped up. The other thing people try to get is, oh, well, they shouldn't have left their firearms in that car. Well, there's actually quite a few reasons that they did, and they couldn't get back to it without loss of life on the police side or civilians. So people can butcher it all they want. In fact, and just like every other video that's out there, you can't quarterback it.
Yeah. And for people who would criticize you and say, well, your job was the news crew, first of all, you did put us behind a big I think it was a potted plant, like a concrete potted plant by the Nordstrom's building. And second, I think you know by now that I was one of the most hated reporters in the crowd. And I don't want a person with a gun in the crowd who hates me. I don't know if those guys individually hated me, but I would say that if they were allowed to take those rifles, every single person in the crowd, including myself and our photographer, were at risk. So that argument just doesn't hold water to me.
The vast majority of people aren't going to consider, unless you have a way of thinking that comes from a military background or just honestly a lot of common sense. So those rifles, those 5.56 AR-15s, what they're called, they were loaded with frangible ammunition. Frangible, what it means is the second hits drywall or anything, it just completely explodes. It just not explodes like violent, but just into dust. They're meant for not penetrating anything, so they don't over-penetrate. But a 5.56 has a max effective range of over 500 yards, which down a city street, especially in Seattle, you can easily do. I shoot, I train, I teach people. I know exactly what those systems can do. You and I and our photographer, videographer, were well within that distance. Everyone was. So even if, you know, according to a lot of executive protection type people, all I did was my job and get you guys out of there. The fact of the matter is, you're still in danger. So is every other American there, regardless of if they are there in a stance that I disagree with or whatever. It wasn't my job to agree or disagree with the riot or the protest or the politics. My job is you guys, and then my duty for myself is to protect those I can. So,
as you noted, you know, you kind of became this growing figure in the Second Amendment kind of crowd, you know, just guns in general. How much have you really weighed in on publicly the gun control debate that has re-intensified? You try to not give your opinion politically on things?
No, every now and then on like Instagram, I'll put up like, hey, this is what's going on. This is where you can go to combat it. But I really don't weigh in on it much. And it's actually something I've thought a lot about for myself and the reasons why. And the thing I keep coming back to is because it's a people thing. It's not a belief thing. So you can have whatever far side here to whatever far side there. And there's way over here that, you know, everything should be allowed. And then there's a complete opposite. It's like, okay, first of all, there's multiple sides to everything. Not every one thing is going to work for every one person. And like recently there was there's a lot of hate going towards Daniel Defense and Ruger, two major firearms manufacturers, because they stated that they do not support abolishing ATF. So everyone took that, well, just about everyone took that to say, oh, they support it. No, that's not what they said. They stated they didn't support abolishing it. The ATFE, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, explosives, does a lot more than try to regulate, not regulate, try to manage firearms and the sale of them and everything. And people tend to forget to listen to the dialogue. Look at the words taking place. Look at the actions. Like, they just want to, they hear and then interpret it how they want and run a million miles. It's like, you can't do that. Just like our situation. You can't do that. You got to look at the situation as it is. Verbiage, just like I teach in my classes, how you think it, how you say it, it's how you do it. Verbiage is very important. What is actually happening is very important. So I try to put out when I do weigh in, like, not just like, okay, a common sense way, because I think it's really overused, but hey, why don't we look at it a little more broad, a little more open, and consider, not to make the decision by it, but consider what they're saying, what's going on, what's actually happening, and make a very smart decision on your opinion, not just a million miles that way. Doesn't make sense to
yeah.
me, and I'm not that kind of person.
Anti-fringe, that's what the podcast is for. I didn't know there was a segment of the 2A folks who wanted to abolish the ATF. I hadn't heard about that. Like, the libertarians?
A huge portion, because the ATF does take of a lot of liberties that they shouldn't. They do try to set out regulations and make laws that they don't have the authority to. They send a lot of letters out to anyone that has like an FFL dealer's license or whatever, or firearms manufacturer, saying, oh, you can't do this, you can't do this. And they've done raids on certain places and certain peoples, saying, like, trying to confiscate all their what they determined to be illegal. And they have vastly overstepped their bounds. But that's not, like, yeah, they need to be reined in, but that's not all they do. And I'm not saying I support or not support. I'm just trying to look at the reality of the situations.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, the raid on Mar-a-Lago, and everybody's like, defund the FBI. And I'm like, okay, let's not defund the agency that, like, helps track down children who have been sex trafficked. And, like, yeah, it's always these very extreme reactions. Just to end with, you know, when you look back at the last 2 years, which I know, like, were pretty crazy for you, if you could go back to that day in the 2020 riots in Seattle and not have worked that day, not have been with our crew that day, would you prefer that? Would you have preferred the whole incident, just you weren't part of it?
I've actually never thought about that. I've never considered it. And no, I'm glad I worked. And one of my mentors about another situation said something to me, and I think it applies to the same thing, is the whatever you want to believe in, whatever you want to call it, but the universe puts you in that position to make that decision that possibly no one else could have. And I've heard from a lot of people, I mean in the tens of thousands of people, saying, oh, I wouldn't have done that, or this is what I would have done, this would have been better, or you know, I don't think anyone else would have made the decision you made. I think I made the right decision, and I don't think it was a decision many people would have, because legally I was within my rights to stop the threat with lethal force on both people. I just found another way.
And I have thought about, well, what if he wasn't there and these people would have kept those guns or kept shooting or whatever it is. So, well, Shooter Rugi, it's nice to see you. I appreciate you joining us on Fridays with Friends. You're about to move across the country, right?
Yep, I'm leaving the next month.
Check in. Don't forget about your friends here in Seattle, okay?
Absolutely not. The Pacific Northwest is still one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
As you know, every Friday, we end the show with our segment, Understanding America, where we read an important text or speech or something from American history to help you better understand this great country of ours. I figured we'd knock off an amendment today. How does the Fourth Amendment sound? I've heard that used a lot and referred to when it comes to Donald Trump and the search of Mar-a-Lago, just as an example. A little bit of background here. A lot of what our country was built upon was in response to how the British monarchy was run. And so this is no difference. There was something in Britain called a writ of assistance. And it was basically these the power to grant these very vague, thin, flimsy warrants to search people's property. And so the Fourth Amendment, text of it's pretty short. Cue my patriotic music, por favor. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, you say, okay, and effects, against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. That, in full, is the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And that is Undivided for today. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. And check out an op-ed I just dropped for subscribers on Patreon and Locals. The headline, "This is the 2024 ticket that can save America if we let it." In it, I make the case for who I believe would be the best president and vice president possible in 2024 based on a variety of factors, including who can give us a break from the absolute absurdity that has been America's politics for the last 6 years or so. So if you want to check that out, visit patreon.com/undivided or become a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. And a reminder, there will not be a regular show on Monday because I want you to unplug and enjoy the holiday with your friends and family. We will instead do our regular Monday show on Tuesday. And I'm really excited because we're going to announce an important partnership to try to get Washington State back on track.